What was it his friend Warwick had said in agony after consuming the water of life? The hawk and the mouse are the same. A true vision, or just ravings? As he watched the frustrated hawk fly away, rising on thermals to where it could survey the desert for any movement, Leet Kynes wondered if the Muad'Dib had escaped by accident, or if it had been crafty enough to take advantage of its circumstances. Fremen saw signs and omens everywhere. It was a common belief that the appearance of a Muad'Dib before making a difficult decision did not bode well, and the important meeting of Siege leaders was about to begin. As planetologist, though, Leet was bothered by something else. The solar scanner, installed by man, had interfered with the chain of desert life, predator and prey. While only an isolated event, Leet considered it in a much larger context, as his father would have done. Even the tiniest of human interferences, when built up over time, could lead to monumental, potentially disastrous changes. Distressed, Leet returned to the Siege. Leathery-faced Fremen leaders arrived from hidden settlements all across the desert. Red Wall Siege made an ideal place for the gathering. Adjoining an extensive network of natural caves and passageways, it could easily accommodate the visitors, who brought their own water, food, and bedding. The visitors would stay for days, weeks if necessary, until an accord could be reached. Leet would keep them here, even if he had to pound heads together to force cooperation. The desert men must coordinate their struggle, deciding on short-term targets and long-term goals. A recovered but still weakened Turok would speak to them about how the Baron was willing to sacrifice entire spice crews just to steal an unrecorded cargo of melange. Then Stilgar would describe what he and his raiders had found in the sacred caves of Hadith Siege. The arriving delegates had traveled great distances by sandworm, or walked in on foot. Others flew at night in stolen ornithopters, which were quickly camouflaged on arrival, or moved into the caves. Dressed in a new Jabba cloak, Leet Kynes greeted each of them as they passed through the door seal entrance into the Siege proper. Beside him stood his dark-haired wife, with their baby daughter and the toddler, Leet Chih. Worked into the silky loops of Farula's hair were tinkling water rings, representing Leet's wealth and status in the tribe. She hovered close to him for as long as she was allowed. Outside, the sun set in a blaze of orange, and early evening settled over the dunes. The women served the men a large communal meal in the Siege gathering chamber, traditional at the outset of such sessions. Leet sat at a low table beside Naib Hainar. In the company of the Siege leaders, Leet offered a toast in honor of the gruff old man. In response, Hainar shook his gray-haired head and declined to make a speech of his own.
"No, Leet, this is your moment. Mine is past."
With a hand missing two fingers from a knife duel long ago, he clasped his son-in-law's arm in a strong grip. After dinner, as the rugged men took their places in the high-vaulted gathering chamber, Leet considered many things. He had prepared well to address this convocation. But would they choose to cooperate and resist the Harkonnens, mobilizing their desert power on Dune? Or would they flee deeper into the wastelands, each tribe fighting for itself? Worst of all, would the Fremen prefer to quarrel with each other, instead of the true enemy, as they had already done too many times in the past? Leet had a plan in mind. Finally, he stood on a high balcony overlooking the floor of the chamber. Romalo, the old Sayadina, stood beside him in a dusty black robe. Her dark eyes peered out of hollows in her face. Hundreds of people stood below, hardened fighters, leaders who had risen through the ranks of their respective tribes. All shared the vision of a green dune. All revered the memory of Omakhines. Additional spectators stood on benches and balconies that zigzagged up the sheer interior walls. The sour odor of unwashed desert men filled the air, along with the sharp turbulence of spice. Sayedina Ramallo extended her age-spotted hands in front of her face, palms turned up to say a blessing. The throng fell silent, heads bowed. On an adjacent balcony, a white-robed Fremen boy sang a traditional lament in a lilting soprano voice, describing in ancient Chakobsa the arduous journeys of their Zensuni ancestors, who had come here after fleeing Poritrin so long ago. When the boy finished, Ramallo glided back into shadows, leaving Leet alone on the high balcony. All eyes looked at him. This was his time. The perfect acoustics of the chamber carried Leet's voice. "My brothers, this is a time of great challenge for us. On distant Kaitain, I informed the Corino Emperor of the Harkonnen atrocities here on Dune. I told him of the destruction of the desert, of Harkonnen squads that hunt Shai-Hulud for sport." A murmur passed through the chamber, but he had merely reminded them of what they already knew. "In my role as Imperial Planetologist, I have requested botanists, chemists, and ecologists. I have begged for vital equipment. I have asked that a large-scale plan be enacted to preserve our world. I have demanded that he force the Harkonnens to cease their crimes and senseless destruction." He paused, letting the suspense build. "But I was dismissed summarily. Emperor Shaddam IV did not care to listen to me." The crowd's vocal displeasure caused the rock floor beneath Leet to tremble. Rigorously independent, the Fremen did not consider themselves true imperial subjects. They viewed the Harkonnens as interlopers, temporary occupants who would be cast aside one day in favor of another ruling house. In time, the Fremen themselves would rule here. Their legends foretold this. "In this great caucus, we must discuss our alternatives as free men. We ourselves must take action to protect our way of life, regardless of the Imperium and its foolish politics." As he spoke, searching for common ground, feeling the spark of passion within his heart, he could sense Ferula somewhere in the cool shadows nearby, listening to every word, giving him strength. The wreckage of man's repeated attempts to control the universe is strewn along the sordid beaches of history. Theater graffiti in Ichan City, Jongleur. The bright and overly decorated passenger lounge of the Weku mass transit ship reminded him of the surreal stage of a play, with sets that were too gaudy and colors too bright. An anonymous passenger in mid-class seating, Tyros Refa sat alone, knowing that his life would never be the same again. The worn furniture, garish signs, and pungent refreshment drinks comforted him in an odd way, a blurring wind of distraction and white noise. He had traveled far from Zanovar and House Tadagari, far from his past. No one noticed Refa's name. No one cared about his destination. From the way his estate had been precisely targeted, from the Imperial spies who had scouted for him, even murderous Shaddam Corino must believe his bastard half-brother had been incinerated on Zanovar. "Why couldn't he have left me alone?" Refa tried to block the noise of the ever-present vendors, persistent and sometimes sarcastic people in dark glasses who sold everything from spice candy to curry fried slig. He could still hear the thrumming, atonal music that overflowed from their ear-clamp headsets. he ignored them utterly. And after being rebuffed for several hours, the Waku vendors finally left him alone. Rafa's hands were raw and chapped. He had scrubbed them repeatedly with the harshest of soaps, but still he could not get rid of the smells of death and smoke that clung to them, the gritty feel of gruesome soot beneath his fingernails. He should never have tried to go back home. Weeping, he had flown his private skimmer over the blistered scar of his estate. He had broken through the restricted recovery zones, bribing officials, outrunning exhausted sentries. Nothing remained of his beautiful, well-tended home and gardens. Nothing at all. A few lumps of drooping stone columns, the overturned bowl of a broken fountain, but no sign of his stately manor house or beautiful fern gardens. Faithful Charents had been cremated to powder, leaving only a scarecrowish shadow on the ground, the mark of what once had been a significant human being. Rafa had landed, stepped out onto the vile-smelling ground, and been engulfed in a strangled silence. Charred stones and black glass had crunched under his boots. He bent to scoop up powder with his fingers, as if hoping he might find some hidden message in the ashes. He dug deeper, but found no living blade of grass, not even the smallest insect. Around him the world was achingly quiet, devoid of breeze and birdsong. Tyros Rafa had never bothered anyone, content with his own pursuits, living a good life. And yet his half-brother had tried to assassinate him to eliminate a perceived threat to the throne. 14 million people slaughtered in a bungled attempt to kill one man. It seemed impossible, even for such a monster. Yet Rafa knew it was true. The Golden Lion throne was stained with the blood of injustice, reminding Rafa of the grand soliloquy tragedies he had once performed on Jongleur. The Imperial Palace echoed with the screams of Zanovar. Standing under the sooty sleet on his ruined land, Rafa howled the Emperor's name, but his voice dissipated like distant thunder. Booked passage on the next highliner from Talagari to Jongleur, where, in his youth, he had spent happy years. He longed to be back among the student actors, the creative and passionate performers in whose company he had enjoyed peace. Traveling unobtrusively, using false documents the docent had long ago arranged for him in case of emergency, Rafa rode the mass transit ship in silence. Pondering everything he had lost, he heard the ebb and flow of passenger conversations. The Soustone gemologist and his wife argued about fracture patterns. Four boisterous young men disagreed loudly about a recent watercourse race they had seen on Perrin 14. A trader laughed with his rival about the humiliation someone named Duke Leto Atreides had dealt to Beakal. Rafa wished they would all just let him contemplate what he must do. Though he had never been aggressive or violent, the scorched ruin of Zanovar had changed him. He was not experienced at seeking justice. Inside, he was in turmoil with loathing for Shaddam, and felt more than a modicum of self-hatred. I am a Carino, too. It is in my blood. Heaving a deep sigh, he slumped deeper into his seat, then got up to wash his hands again. Before the brutal attack, Rafa had researched his family history, going back centuries to when the Carinos were the model of ethics for the Imperium, to the enlightened reign of Crown Prince Raphael Carino, as portrayed in the dramatic masterpiece My Father's Shadow. Glax Othon had made Rafa into the man he was. Now, though, he had no choice, no past, no identity. Law is the ultimate science. This great concept of justice, first uttered long ago, echoed bitterly in his mind. It was said to be inscribed over the door to the Emperor's study on Kaitain, but he wondered if Shaddam had ever read it. In the hands of the throne's current occupant, imperial law shifted like quicksand. Rafa knew of mysterious deaths in his family. Shaddam's older brother Fafnir, Elrud the Ninth himself, and even Rafa's own mother Shando, who'd been hunted down like an animal on Bela Tejus. He could never forget the faces of Charents either, or the Docent, or the innocent victims of Zanovar. He intended to rejoin his old acting troupe, under the tutelage of the brilliant taskmaster Holden Wong. But if the Emperor discovered Rafa was still alive, would all of Jongleur be at risk too? He dared not reveal his secret. A slight change in the Holtzman hum told Rafa that the Highliner had emerged from fold space. Before long, a female Waku voice announced their arrival and reminded passengers to purchase souvenirs. From five overhead storage compartments, Rafa removed all of his remaining possessions. Everything. He'd had to pay dearly for the extra space, but he didn't trust direct shipment of the special items he had purchased before leaving Talagari. Followed by a bobbing train of suspensor cases, he made his way toward the exit. Even as passengers waited in line for the descent shuttle, Waku vendors kept trying to sell them trinkets, though without much success. When Rafa stepped into the spaceport terminal on Jongleur, his dark mood lifted. The large facility was crowded with people full of good cheer and smiles. The atmosphere was refreshing. He prayed he had not put another precious world at risk. Looking around at families and friends greeting the passengers, he saw no sign of Master Holden Wong, who had promised to meet him here. Rafa's old troop must have had a performance scheduled for that evening, and Wong always insisted on supervising everything himself. Living entirely in his world of acting, the master paid little attention to current events, probably didn't even know about the attack on Zanovar. He seemed to have forgotten to meet his guest at the dock. No matter. Rafa knew his own way around the city. A dock adjoined the spaceport, from which a sampan water taxi carried passengers into Ichan City across a broad river dappled with a carpet of lavender algae. As the boat puttered across the slow current, Rafa stood on the deck, filling his lungs with refreshing, moist air. So different from the sour smoke and char of Zanovar. Ahead, seen through a thin river fog, Ichan City was a jumble of ramshackle buildings and modern high-rises, crowded with rickshaws and pedestrians. From the cabin below, he heard laughter and the music of a string quartet, balisset, rebec, violin, and rababa. The water taxi slowed, and reversed its engines as it docked. Rafa followed other passengers onto the old city pier, a sturdy wooden structure whose planked surface was scattered with fish scales, crushed shells, and straw-like crustacean legs. Amidst seafood stands and pastry shops, merry troops of storytellers worked alongside musicians and jugglers, providing samples of their talents and passing out invitations to evening performances. Rafa watched a mime playing the part of a bearded god rising from the sea. Catching his eye, the mime moved closer, making oddly contorted expressions with his pasty white face. His painted grin spread even wider. "Hello, Tyros. I came to greet you after all." Rafa recovered and said, "Holden Wong, when a mime speaks, does he impart wisdom or reveal his folly?"
"Well said, my good friend."
Wong had attained the rank of Supreme Thespian, highest of all master jongleurs. With protuberant cheekbones, slitted eyes, and a wispy beard, he was over 80 years old, but moved like a much younger man. He had no inkling of Rafa's parentage, or of the sudden and spiteful price placed on his head by Shaddam. The old troop leader put an arm around Rafa's shoulder, leaving white grease paint marks on his clothing. "Will you attend our performance this evening? Catch up on what you have been missing all these years?" "That, and I hope to find a place in your troupe again, master." Wong's deep brown eyes danced. "Ah, to have a talented actor again! For comedy? Romance? I, for one, would prefer tragedy and drama. My heart is too heavy for comedy or romance." "Ah, I am certain we shall find something for you." Wong patted Reffa on the head, this time jokingly leaving white grease paint in his dyed black hair. "I am pleased to have you back among the jongleurs, Tyros." Reffa grew more serious. "I have heard you are planning a new production of My Father's Shadow." "Quite so. I am just now scheduling the rehearsals for an important performance. We have not completed the casting yet, though we leave for Kaitane in a few weeks to entertain the Emperor himself." The mime seemed delighted with his good fortune. Rafa's eyes became intense. "I would give my soul to play the part of Raphael Corino." The master jongleur studied the younger man and detected deep fire in him. "Another actor has been selected, though he doesn't have the spark the role requires. Yes, you just might be better. I feel I was born to play him." Reffa drew a deep breath, but he covered the smoldering expression with the skill of a master actor. "Shaddam the Fourth has provided me with all the inspiration I need." What can I say about Jessica? Given the opportunity, she would attempt voice on God. Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam. It hardly seemed appropriate for a well-respected duke and his concubine to make love in a cluttered storeroom. But time was short, and Leto knew he would miss her desperately. Jessica was due to leave for Kaitane in the highliner that circled Caladan. She would be gone by the next morning. Only a few steps down the corridor, cooks attended to their duties in the kitchen, banging pans, cracking mussels, chopping herbs. One of them could pop in at any moment to look for dried spices or a bag of salt. But after he and Jessica had slipped inside the cluttered room, each carrying a glass of dry claret taken during an earlier tryst in the wine cellar, Leto had blocked the door with several crates of imported bitterberry tins. He had also managed to bring the bottle with him, which he rested on a box in the corner. 2 weeks ago, after Romber's wedding, these unlikely liaisons had begun as a whim, an idea inspired by her imminent departure for Kaitane. Eventually, Leto wanted to make love to her in every room in the castle, closets not included. Though pregnant, Jessica was up to the challenge, and seemed both amused and delighted. The stately young woman set her wine glass on a shelf, her green eyes sparkling. "Do you meet serving wenches in here too, Leto?" "I hardly have enough energy for you. Why would I exhaust myself further?" He moved three dusty jars of preserved lemons from the top of a large crate. "I'll need a few months alone just to regain my strength." "I should hope so, but this must be our last time today." Jessica's tone was gentle, almost scolding. "I haven't finished packing." "And the Emperor's wife won't be able to provide clothing for her new lady-in-waiting?" She kissed his cheek and removed the black Atreides jacket he wore. Folding the garment carefully, she laid it down with the hawk crest showing. She then peeled his shirt off, sliding it down his shoulders to expose his chest. "Allow me to prepare a suitable bed, my lady." Opening the crate, Leto removed a sheet of bubble plaz used for packing fragile items. He spread it on the floor. "You offer all the comfort I need." Moving their wine glasses out of harm's way, she showed him that she could make do even in a small storeroom, with nothing but bubble plaz beneath them.
As she held him afterward, Leto said, "Things would be different if I weren't a duke. Sometimes I wish you and I could just..." His words trailed off. Gazing into his gray eyes, Jessica saw his unspoken love for her, a chink in the armor of this proud, frequently aloof man. She handed him his glass of claret, took a sip of her own. "I make no demands upon you." She remembered the resentment that had gnawed at his first concubine, Kylea, who had never seemed to appreciate anything he did for her. Leto began to dress himself awkwardly. "I want to say so many things to you, Jessica. I am sorry I held a knife to your throat at our first meeting. It was only to show the sisterhood that I could not be manipulated. I never would have used it against you."
"I know that."
She kissed him on the lips. Even with the sharp edge pressed against her jugular all those years ago, she had never felt any real threat from Leto Atreides. "Your apology is worth more than any trinket or jewel you could have given me." Leto ran his fingers through her long bronze hair, studying the perfection of her small nose, generous mouth, and elegant figure. He could hardly believe she was not of noble blood. He sighed, knowing he could never marry this woman. His father had made that only too clear. "Never marry for love, boy. Think first of your house and of its position in the Imperium. Think of your people. They will rise or fall with you." Still, Jessica carried his baby. And he had promised himself that their child would bear the Atreides name and inheritance, regardless of other dynastic considerations. Another son, he hoped. As if attuned to his thoughts, Jessica placed a finger over his lips. She understood that, with all of his pain and concerns, Leto was not ready for commitment. But it buoyed her spirit to see him struggling with his emotions, just as she did. A Bene Gesserit axiom intruded on her thoughts. Passion clouds reason. She hated the constraints of such admonitions. Teacher Mohiam, faithful and stern, had raised her under the strict guidance of the sisterhood, sometimes doing hurtful things and inflicting harsh lessons. But for all that, Jessica still felt a pull of love for the old woman, and respect for what the Reverend Mother had achieved in her. More than anything else, Jessica did not want to disappoint Mohiam. But she had to be true to herself as well. She had done things for her own love, for Leto. He stroked the soft skin of her abdomen, still flat, not yet showing the curve of pregnancy. He smiled, letting his barriers down, loving her. He allowed his hopes to show. "Before you go, Jessica, tell me, is it a son?" She toyed with his dark hair, but turned her face away, wanting to be close to him, but afraid she might reveal too much. "I have not allowed Dr. Yue to perform any tests, my Duke. The sisterhood frowns on such interference." Leto's smoke-gray eyes were intent, and he chided her. "You are a Bene Gesserit. You let yourself get pregnant after the death of Victor, and I appreciate that more than I can ever tell you." His face softened with obvious love for her, an emotion he rarely showed in front of others. She took a hesitant step toward him, wanting Leto to fold her in his arms, but he pressed for answers. "So, is it a son? You know, don't you?" Her legs went weak, and she sat back on the crate. She flinched from his hard gaze, but she wouldn't lie to him. "I cannot tell you, my Duke." He was taken aback, the light-hearted mood gone now. "You can't tell me because you don't know the answer, or you won't tell me for a secret reason of your own." Refusing to allow herself to become distraught, Jessica gazed at him with clear green eyes. "I cannot tell you, my Duke, so please do not ask."
Finding the open bottle of wine again, she poured him another glass, which he declined. Leto turned from her, his stance rigid. "Well, I've been thinking. If it is a son, I have decided to name him Paul in honor of my father." Primly, Jessica took a sip of her own wine. Despite the embarrassment, she hoped that a servant would interrupt them by barging into the pantry. "Why does he have to raise such matters now?" "That is your decision, my Duke. I never met Paulus Atreides, and I know him only through what you have said about him. My father was a great man. The people of Caladan loved him."
"I have no doubt of that."
She looked away, gathering her clothes and dressing.
"But he was coarse.
I disagree with many things your father taught you. Personally, I would prefer another name." Leto raised his aquiline nose, his pride and pain outweighing any desire for concession with her. Regardless of what he wanted, he had mastered the art of erecting fortress walls around his heart. "You forget your place." She set her wine glass down with a heavy click that nearly broke the delicate crystal. It overbalanced on the uneven crate and spilled. Abruptly, Jessica turned to the pantry door, surprising him.
"If you only knew what I've done for your love."
She left, straightening her clothes. Leto cared for her deeply, though he didn't always understand her. He followed her down the interior castle corridors, ignoring the servants' curious stares, longing for her acceptance. With quiet footsteps, she moved swiftly through pools of light cast by glow globes and entered her private chamber. She knew he followed, knew he would probably grow angrier because she'd made him pursue her. Leto stopped at the threshold of her suite, and, trembling, she whirled to confront him. At the moment, she didn't want to mask her own anger, wanted to feel it and get it out. But the scars of anguish were written across his face, not simply sorrow for the tragic deaths of Victor and Kylia, but also for his slain father. It was not her place to hurt him further, and it was not her place as a Bene Gesserit to love him either. She felt the anger drain out of her. Leto had loved the old Duke. Paulus Atreides had taught him about politics and marriage, rigid rules that did not allow for the love between a man and a woman. His adherence to his father's teachings had turned his first concubine's devotion into murderous treachery. But Leto had also watched his father gored to death by a drug-maddened Seleucid bull and been forced to become Duke Atreides at a young age. Was it so wrong that he wanted to name his new son after Paulus? She was leaving tomorrow for Kytane, and she might not see him for months. Indeed, as a Bene Gesserit sister, there would be no guarantee that she would ever be allowed to return to Caladan, especially when they discovered the sex of the baby she carried, in defiance of their commands.
"I will not leave him like this."
Before the Duke could speak at the doorway, she said,
"Yes, Leto. If the child is a boy, Paul will be his name. We need argue no more about it."
Early the following morning, at the hour when fishing boats departed from the Cala City docks to ply channels through distant kelp beds, Jessica awaited the time of her departure. Just down the corridor, she heard angry words coming from the Duke's private study. The door stood ajar, and the black-robed Gaius Helen Mohiam sat in a high-backed chair just inside the room. She recognized the woman's voice from years spent under her tutelage at the mother school. "The sisterhood has made the only possible decision, Duke Atreides," Mohiam said. "We do not understand the ship or the process ourselves, and we have no intention of providing clues to any other noble family. Not even House Atreides. With respect, sir, your request is denied." Jessica inched closer.
Others were in the study with them. She identified the voices of Thufir Hawat, Duncan Idaho, and Gurney Halleck. Gurney roared,
"What's to prevent the Harkonnens from using it on us again?"
"They cannot reproduce the weapon, so the inventor must be unavailable. Probably dead."
"The Bene Gesserit brought this to our attention, Reverend Mother," Leto barked. "You personally told me of the Harkonnen plot against me. For years I have put aside my pride, not using the information to clear my name. But now my purpose is more important. Do you doubt my ability to use the weapon in a sensible manner?"
"Your good name stands without question. My sisters know this. Nonetheless, we have decided that such technology is too dangerous for any one man, or house, to hold." She heard a crash in the study, and Leto spoke in a loud, angry voice.
"You're taking my lady, too. One affront after another. I insist that my man here, Gurney Halleck, accompany Jessica as bodyguard. For her own protection, I dare not risk her."
Mohiam sounded exceedingly rational. A hint of voice? "The Emperor has promised safe passage to Kaitain and protection in the palace. Fear not, your concubine will be well cared for. The rest is out of your hands." She rose to her feet, as if to indicate the conclusion of the meeting.
"Jessica will soon be the mother of my child," Leto said, his words carrying a deadly edge. "See that she is kept safe, or I will hold you personally responsible, Reverend Mother."
Her heart soaring at these words, Jessica saw Mohiam make a subtle body movement, shifting to a barely detectable fighting stance. "The sisterhood is capable of protecting the girl better than any former smuggler can." Boldly, Jessica stepped into the room, interrupting the escalating tensions. "Reverend Mother, I am ready to depart for Kaitain if you will allow me to say my farewells to the Duke." The man in the room hesitated, startled into an uncomfortable silence. Mohiam looked at her, making it clear that she had known Jessica was eavesdropping all along.
"Yes, child. It is time."
Watching the dwindling glow from the shuttle engines, Duke Leto Atreides stood in the spaceport below, surrounded by Gurney, Thufir, Romber, and Duncan. Poor men who would have given their lives for him if he asked it. He felt empty and alone, and thought of all the things he wished he'd had the courage to say to Jessica. But he had lost his chance, and would regret it until they were in each other's arms again. One cannot hide from history or from human nature. Bene Gesserit Ajar Book. The ancient rock quarry was a deep bowl with high cliff walls of chopped stone. In centuries past, blocks of variegated marble had been removed to build new structures for the mother school. Stern and professional, Sister Christine led the three Richesian inventors to the bottom of the quarry. Her dark hair cropped short, her face showing more angles than feminine softness, she did not appear to notice the cold breezes as she took the trio of off-world scientists into a suspensor pod that dropped like a diving bell past colored bands of mineral impurities. The inventors were a mixed batch. One was boisterous and political, having achieved success through writing excellent reports as opposed to doing superb research. His two companions were quieter and more self-absorbed, but their flashes of inspiration had produced technological wildcards that brought in a great deal of money for Richies. It had taken the sisterhood weeks to track them down, to concoct an appropriate excuse to bring them here. Ostensibly, these three men had been summoned to discuss retooling the mother school's power systems, to develop direct satellite links that would not interfere with the defensive screens surrounding Wallach 9. The Richesian government had been eager to offer their creative skills to the powerful Bene Gesserit. The pretext had succeeded. In actuality,
Arishka had requested these specific inventors because of their connections to the vanished Chobin. They might have access to the records of his work, or know something important about what he had done.
"We have traveled far from the main complex," said the meek inventor named Halloa Rund.
Looking around as the suspensor pod descended, Rund noted the isolation of the quarry. It held few buildings and no noticeable rock-working technology.
"What power requirements could you possibly have so far from your main complex?"
Having once studied at the Mentat School and failed, Rund still prided himself on his analytical mind. He was also a nephew of Count Ilban Rachiz, and had used his family connections to receive funding for eccentric projects that would have been denied to anyone else. His uncle doted on all of his own relatives.
"Mother Superior is waiting below," Christine answered, as if that would dispel any doubts.
"And we have a problem for you to solve." Earlier, around the mother school, Run's two associates had been enamored with the scenery, the orchards, and the stucco buildings with terracotta tile roofs. Few men were ever allowed to visit Wallach 9, and they drank in all the details like tourists, happy to go wherever the sisters wanted to take them. The suspensor pod reached the bottom of the quarry, where the men emerged and looked around. The razor breezes were sharp and cold. Rock cliffs rose in a stair-step formation above them like an enclosed stadium. The wreckage of the strange vessel lay covered with electro-tarps, with its hull still visible under the slanting light. Mother Superior Harishka and several black-robed companions stood next to the ship. The Rachizian inventors came forward, intrigued.
"What is this, a small scout fighter?"
Talis Balt was a bald, bookish man who could do even complex equations in his head.
"I was given to understand the Sisterhood had no overt military capability. Why would you own..."
"This is not ours," Christine replied.
"We were attacked, but managed to destroy the vessel. It appears to have been equipped with a new form of defensive screen that makes it invisible to human eyes or scanning devices."
"Impossible,"
Anto Kinnis, the bureaucrat of the group. Though only a mid-level scientist, he had supervised highly successful technological teams.
"Nothing is impossible, Director," Halloa Rund countered, his voice stern. "The first step in innovation is to know that a thing can be created. After that, the rest is a matter of detail."
And attached a transmitter to remove a corner of the electro-tarp, revealing the scratched and scarred fuselage of a small warship. "We have reason to believe this technology was developed by a Rachizian named Tenu Chobin, a person of your acquaintance. The Bene Gesserit must learn whether any of you have additional information on his operations."